Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Anti-Imperialist Scholars Collective podcast, or as our friend Bikram calls it, the IISC podcast.
What?
Here with episode number 5. We are so excited to have you here. My name is Diego Alcala, and I'm joined by, why don't you guys introduce yourself?
Go ahead. I'm
Naveed Farnia.
When did I ever say ISK? I never said
ISK. Sir, what is your name? What is your name?
My name is Bikram.
Bikram, you have said it's the ICE,
ICE podcast.
I don't know. I'm just obsessed with ICE. I'm sorry. So, guys, welcome back to the podcast. We're very excited to be here. We are looking forward to this episode. We'll have a few topics. Some of them include the buildup in the Caribbean. I'll talk a little bit about Puerto Rico, but we'll look primarily at the military buildup of the United States in the area. How does that influence Venezuela, Colombia, and some statements? We'll also be looking at Lebanon, and we'll talk about Russia. And we remind everyone that we have our first event on Russia today. So we will be talking about that in the next podcast, hopefully. And then we'll talk a little bit about other issues of importance. So let's get right to it. I think we already went through the really cool background music. So now we're just going to jump right in, right? There's a war in the Caribbean, guys. Again.
Ongoing.
Yes, there is.
Okay, do you guys want to elaborate on that, or would you guys... Who wants to pick a couple of minutes?
Yeah, I can pick up. As you all know, like there's a U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean that seems to be accelerating by the day. Almost daily drone strikes on fishing boats with what the U.S. government calls drug boats that, you know, they cannot conceivably be drug boats. Like they're little boats that there's no way they can get from Venezuela to Miami or to even Haiti or whatever. But nonetheless, this is what the U.S. government is calling them. The Venezuelan state and the people are building up as well. They're getting ready for a military confrontation. It's interesting, like what the Gustavo Petro said in Colombia yesterday, talking about proposing the formation or the reformation of Gran Colombia. I don't know if you all saw that.
Yeah.
Yes. That is, you know, like if there's any follow through on that, that would be quite the thing.
I think there's a bunch of stuff that you just threw out there. Let's just slow it down, give Bikram an opportunity to get more coffee in him. And that way we can make sure he activates.
Why did you assume it was coffee?
You're just going to jump in, aren't you?
No. I'm saying, why did you assume it was coffee, though?
Let's call it coffee. It's better for the kids, okay? All right, Naveed.
Okay,
we have a situation in which the United States has declared war against what they call international drug cartels, and it's using international humanitarian law to justify the direct attack of fishing vessels in the Caribbean and in the Pacific Ocean. But let's concentrate on the Caribbean. That is one of the many actions that have been going on. And you then jump into Venezuela. So let's walk us through the whole Venezuela. Why are they getting ready? What's going on with that?
Bikram, you want to take that?
You go ahead. And then there's a couple points that you had mentioned that I wanted to just like follow up on. But I think like the question of why targeting Venezuela? Go ahead, Naveed.
Yeah, so we've talked about this previously on the podcast, right? So, you know, like part of it is the Venezuela's, resources. Obviously, oil being the major one. Venezuela has the greatest oil reserves in the world, of any country in the world, including Saudi Arabia, including Iran, including Russia, including the United States. So that is a major aspect of it, right? And then the other aspect of it is like this sort of Monroe Doctrine, political, military, the U.S. Playing an increased role, particularly as it recedes on the global sphere and on the global landscape with respect to China and Russia, playing an increased military role, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, right? So those are the two major aspects to it. And yeah, I mean, I'll also say, like, a lot of people talk about Monroe Doctrine, which they should, but also, like, it's also a reflection of, like, in the early 1900s, President Theodore Roosevelt made the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which also gave, like, international police powers to the United States, right? So it's a continuation of all of this. And yeah, you can, Bikram, you can.
Yeah, so I think the point that I would just add, it's one that I've raised in earlier episodes that we've had, Naveed, is, and I think, like, you know, Diego, when you're talking about the targeting of drug, supposed, like, drug-running boats, whether off the coast of Venezuela or elsewhere, you know, it reminds us of a point that we've come to, is what is imperialism? You know, like, so I think, like, there's one point targeting a country's resources, but there's something else that I think we need to emphasize again and again. Imperialism, especially under capitalism, is concerned very much with questions of flows and not just with place and territory, right? So what is the relationship between states? What is the relationship of the movement of goods between states, right? That's what imperialism really seeks to control. And so, like, one element is to establish the projection of power, a price setting power in terms of the movement of oil into and out of Venezuela, right? Or, like, out of Venezuela, the movement of goods into the Caribbean, the movement of goods into and out of the Americas. It's a way to establish that control. So you might not even need ownership over the oil, but what you want is to ensure that the Chinese or the Russians don't have direct access. So the imperialist power seeks to maintain domination over the relations between states. This is what will provision a price-setting power. And that's where I find very interesting Petro's comments, because we've seen in recent years a contradiction of sanctions, for example. Sanctions are meant to actually control relations between states, not simply punish the targeted state, but also make it difficult for other states to trade with that state. But we've seen this contradiction there, where targeted states are deepening their relation with one another, right? So we'll see Iran and Venezuela or Cuba deepening their relations out of almost material necessity. And if one element of the buildup in the Caribbean and the Monroe Doctrine is to balkanize the Americas, right, is to keep it fractured and to keep Washington as the glue that holds whatever it is together, you see Petro is actually, it seems like this process is generating an impulse towards potentially unity, unity of the Americas, right? Like in that way. So that's an interesting kind of dynamic we're seeing at play here.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in because you mentioned something important as to the flow and control of flow. And we saw that when Trump got into power and his claim to the Panama Canal, right? It wasn't necessary for the United States to actually invade Panama and take over that route. Extremely important trading route. But it was enough to trigger the government of Panama to back off whatever relationship they had with a Chinese company that was going to be administering the canal. So as you correctly point out, it's the flow that is as important as the physical nature of the control. Now, I'll also add to the dimension of physical control, I happen to be from Puerto Rico, the oldest colony in the world, who happens to be controlled by the United States. And I get so frustrated every time I listen to Bikram talking about sovereignty and the control. And I'm like, why is he talking about me again? He doesn't need to. I understand. Puerto Rico is a colony. I get it. But in this particular moment, we see why Puerto Rico is a colony. We are primarily not only a market, but more importantly, it is a military outpost. It's been forever. Yeah. Where the Spanish wanted Puerto Rico in order to control all flow from the European states to Latin America. And Puerto Rico, sitting in its position, is the most important island militarily in the area. There's a big issue going on in Puerto Rico currently. There's a lot of resistance to the increased military presence. For those who may not remember, back in the 90s, Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans united in doing mass mobilizations, protest in order to ensure that the U.S. Navy leaves the municipal island of Vieques, which is off the coast of Puerto Rico to the east. It's one of two islands that the United States Navy utilized and rented out in order to train Marines and within and other exercises, which created, and we still have, significant pollution from that area. that increase in military activity in the Caribbean has reactivated not only the Roosevelt Roads facility, but other facilities that were running on minimum, but also maybe abandoned too. So those particular locations have been taken over by U.S. personnel, which brings not only those memories, but also a fresh bunch of soldiers. We have reports coming in from island of Vieques in which Marines or other soldiers are asking the local community where they can get girls and other matters that would be attuned to what underground economies sustain these type of militaries. But the damage has been done. It isn't that far off since we were able to ensure some mass movement against the U.S. military. And seeing that come back has been very, very fresh. I think most people don't want that, but it's out of our hands. Right now, we've seen images for the past month of not only equipment being brought in, but training exercises off the coast of one, two, or three municipalities that are near the southern coast of Puerto Rico. And there's nothing we can do about it, right? We have to remember that we still have massive environmental damage associated with the bombings of the locations in the area, which the U.S. Navy has, like many other instances, refused to take any responsibility for. And we also have the current practices also damaging many areas in the locations that they're practicing. So just throwing that out there, because there is a real harm aside from the obvious prospect of war or the theoretical aspects of what geopolitical steps are being taken within empire and outside of empire. But currently we are, along with others, of course, is unique to the Puerto Rico population, but it is an important component of the naval strategy of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I'll also say that, you know, to what both of you are saying, I think they're like, I think naval power, the importance of naval power is at the forefront of like what's happening around the globe, and particularly in the Caribbean, as we see, right? Like, I mean, China just commissioned a new aircraft carrier, I think was last week, I think nuclear powered aircraft carrier, right? But, you know, so I've been thinking about this question of like the utility of sanctions, right? I think, you know, Bikram, we've talked about this, and I think we're going to talk about it with respect to Russia later on. I think, you know, a lot of these sanctions are less and less producing the intended effect of the United States. And because of this, I think we're witnessing a lot more, as you all have pointed out, like physical power in the seas, right? And so I think we're going to continue to see more and more of these kinds of physical blockades as a sort of way to, you know, as a way to try to counter or not counteract, but try to like, make up for what sanctions are not doing, like financial sanctions are not doing in terms of their intended effect, right? Because of the receding power of the U.S. dollar and the global economy and these kinds of things. So, yeah.
I wanted to add something before Bikram jumps in. It was based on the fact that you mentioned something around Petro and the Gran Colombia scheme. I think that is important to remember or to inform our viewers that through these strikes, it's not only Venezuelan fishermen that are being affected. We have multiple nationalities such as Trinidad Tobago and Ecuador and Colombian nationals being affected by these strikes. And one of the people, Gustavo Petro, was in one of his declarations, was accusing the United States of extrajudicial killings, along with many others, right? But Petro's comments created or accelerated a position from Washington in which sanctions were imposed. And now the government is not only experimenting the possibility of additional sanctions, but also Petro himself is sanctioned, but also he's being tied as a gang leader of this narco state. We have this vocabulary of always utilizing drug dealing as a police law enforcement type of tactic. But now we're seeing that tie between narco traffic, terrorism, and there, hence, we can legitimately overthrow you. That's what Lindsey Graham, Senator of the United States, mentioned today, equating the Panama arrest of Manuel Noriega in the 90s and just justifying today's actions based on that precedent. Of course, he doesn't mention that there are many Latin American useful officers and personnel and government officials that are actually tied to drug trafficking, but the United States does not act on those particular moments based on the fact that that particular person is currently helping the United States versus what is going on right now. Anyone that is a hindrance to the United States is labeled as a drug trafficker, drug trafficker leader, and hence a terrorist. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bikram.
Well, no, I was just thinking about this point, Diego, that you're kind of returning us to, which is like a fundamental, I think, relation of imperialism and the contemporary world order. And it's demonstrative of where things are, maybe where they're going, either in terms of the challenge to U.S. imperialism, or maybe it's a kind of continuing power in the sense that, you know, the striking of these ships, it's an attempt to reproduce this question of impunity, right? Like who was able to raise up the threat of force and then inflict it? But with impunity, right? But I think so, like, the, you know, this has been the rule of the imperialist system for centuries now, is that, like, when the colonized or the non-European or the non-Western strike, that violence is considered existential, a threat to civilization, whereas the reverse, the strikes from north to south, the strike of the imperialist is always granted impunity because it's attached to some higher purpose, right? So whether it's fighting terrorism, fighting drug runners, et cetera. So I think, however much, this is something that I've been struggling with of late. It's not like a existential issue for me in some ways, but it's just something I'm trying to come to terms with, is what does it mean to speak of the challenge to U.S. imperialism, but exist in a world where it's still able to be the one force that can strike with impunity? You know, like, you can launch raids on Libya, but you won't see Libya lead a collection of states to launch raids on France, right? That we can't even imagine that world. But at the same time, what you're also seeing in this impunity, though, you know, I think, like, there's some, what underlies, like, a lot of this is, you know, Trump wants a deal, right? Or the Americans, they always want to use force to get other states to sign on to something. You know, like, so there's an impunity that's demonstrated, and then say, okay, sign a deal with us. So there's like a constitutionalism with which they seek to legitimize their imperial power. That question seems to be no longer assured, right? It's not like Diego Petro is being sanctioned and backing off, right? It's although, you know, you may see India now saying we'll stop buying Russian oil or whatever, right? But you're seeing Petro actually double down, right? And then you're also seeing this lead to more sharpening of contradictions within the imperialist block. I think it was the UK that said they don't agree with the targeting of, I may be mistaken, because...
No, they stopped sharing intelligence briefings with the United States based on these particular attacks.
Yeah, so it's like, I think how blatant it is, the disregard for any form of law of war or any rule of engagement, any rule of war, like any in any sense is, I think, and then, I mean, I brought this up in previous episodes and I don't know enough here. I think the other thing to put on the table, that's interesting, I didn't know the stopping of sharing of intelligence, but, like, there is a link that's worth exploring at some point between the US's gambit on oil and gas, artificial intelligence, and the way they're launching these raids, you know, because we know in Gaza, for example, the role that Palantir and these firms played in constructing kill lists using artificial intelligence. You know, there's an open question, like there's this military finance AI intersection we're seeing in this kind of U.S. attempt to renew its mode of accumulation. I don't know how the British decision fits in on that. And yeah, so Diego, you were right, but I'm not going to tell you about what. But
oh, I know exactly what you're going to say, but I'll let David jump in because we want to hear from him now.
Just a couple of things, right? In addition to UK, I did see that Panama's president also is saying that They're not going to allow the U.S. to use their territory as a sort of, I guess, launching pad to strike and hit Venezuela. I don't know how true that is. You know, one can say something and you know, that might be totally different from the reality, right? Diego, do you know the name of Panama's president? Or
no, but you know, the magic of the internet. Hold on.
but, you know, like this person, you know, the president, you know,
Jose Raul Mulino. I'm sorry, Navid.
Okay.
Mulino.
Okay. Yeah. So
MU. Yep.
He talked a big game on the canal, but I think he, you know, like quickly acquiesced to the US's sort of demands with the Panama Canal. So what we hear from him might not be what the reality is. Right. The other thing I'll say, you know, I think Petro is an interesting character, right? Because I think we've talked about this. You know, others in our group have talked about this. Petro has been very outspoken with respect to Palestine, with respect to the genocide. He's been outspoken with what's going on with respect to in this region now in the Caribbean. But he also has a pretty poor record when it comes to Haiti, right? He's basically an interventionist with respect to Haiti. So, you know, these are also contradictions that need to be resolved. And, you know, like for those who identify as anti-imperialists, right? I would say that Petro seems to be shifting in the leftward direction. Again, but it's also about like, you talk the talk, can you walk the walk, right?
He did mention just recently about how the United States, in order to protect pedophiles, is willing to invade Venezuela. So to get off the Epstein file list, he was making sure that everyone understood that this is part of that calculus too. It's a way to distract from the issues in domestic. So war may also be used in order to shift attention, right?
Yeah, although if we do make it to that point of the discussion, like around the Zionism-imperialism relationship, we'll see that maybe these aren't simply distractions. Maybe that issue is entangled in all of this as well, right?
We'll get there. But any final words about this? I mean, this for sure will not be the final conversation that we have in this podcast. We just wanted to touch base on where we were right now. We know that the biggest naval ship has arrived at the Caribbean already. So it's, I think somewhere around 10% of all U.S. naval forces are now in the Caribbean, which is an unprecedented move or an unprecedented strategic move, not since the Iraq War. That it has been made in these past couple of days. So I'll just stop now. And if anyone wants to jump in with our final words, by all means, regarding this topic.
Sorry, go ahead, Navid.
Bikram, go ahead. Like you can. I do have a word. I do.
Bikram. Yeah. No. Go ahead, Navid. No, and I don't want Bikram to talk anymore.
Okay. I want to say something from like the anti-imperialist position in the United States, like the anti-war against Venezuela position in the United States, because we haven't seen, others have said this, we haven't seen like the level of resistance to strikes against Venezuela and even Colombia and Trinidad and Tobago that we have seen, that we saw against like in the war in Iraq, obviously the genocide in Palestine and so on and so forth, right? It's troubling. It's very troubling that, you know, this socialist country in the Caribbean and in Latin America is not generating the kind of, you know, anti-war sentiment that we would wish for, right? But at the same time, like, I talk about Venezuela, what's happening in Venezuela with my classes, and it clearly resonates with these students. Like I talk about like the power of sanctions and how sanctions have, you know, led people to like starve, right? Like 40,000 deaths, right? You know, like in 1 year in Venezuela because of the sanctions, right? If you all haven't heard of the report by Venezuela Analysis, A War Without Bombs, talking about the impact of sanctions, right? And that's from a few years ago. You know, and it sort of talks about the impact in various sectors of Venezuelan society. All these things actually resonate like with young people. So how is it like that these things resonate, but it doesn't drive like, you know, those people who are organizers and activists and those who might become mobilized for anti-genocide protests to go out in the streets to talk about Venezuela, right? You know, I think that's that's, you know, maybe that's the too long of a discussion for right now, but it's something that is worthy of further analysis.
There's no such thing as too long.
discussion, and we what a great transition to Bikram. Why don't you go ahead and start our next topic? Go ahead.
Can I just quickly?
That's completely false, but it's not going to be quickly. So take your time. We're not in a hurry.
30 seconds.
You take your time. Okay.
So like this question of, I don't know if that's entirely like accurate, Naveed, because I think the comparison is not necessarily Iraq with Venezuela, but you know, we do know that there was a war on terror that conducted drone strikes from South Asia all the way to the Horn of Africa that did not lead to anti-war protests and mobilizations either. So I think, and people would have been upset about this, but there is a question to ask more generally about sanctions and the quote unquote targeted strikes, or the way things are presented as police type actions. You know, because even when they bombed Venezuela, Iraq and Afghanistan, the response was, whoa, you should have had surgical police type rather than all out war. Right. So I think there's this question of, I think it returns us to normalized violence, right? That there is a way in which there's an assumed to be rationality that's attached to police actions that are presented as policing contained that aren't in the scope of explicit regime change war. Right. It seems like all of us are able to live with that on a daily basis without being moved, right, to that. And I think it's an important question to ask, but it's like the war on terror. There was a war on drugs. There's a war on terror. Back to the logic of the war on drugs. But there seems to be some way that is normalized. And I was like,
it is the meshing. I think you hit it. It's both are getting united at this particular juncture in time. And now we see the force of attacking terrorists with the justification of the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. And with that great finale on my end, we'll move on to the next topic, and we're going to shift gears now, if that's okay with both of you. Okay, I was wondering if we can jump into Lebanon. I know Naveed, you wanted to talk a little bit about Lebanon, and I want to give you the opportunity just to explain what's going on. Where do you want to go?
I mean, obviously, with respect to Lebanon, you know, since the so-called ceasefire, Bikram, help me out. When was that ceasefire in Lebanon? November of 24?
Yeah, at the end of November.
Yeah, so a year now. Oh, yeah, because it was the day after the HDS offensive began, right? But since then, the Zionists have committed thousands of violations, literally thousands, like I think over 5,000. And so, you know, what are they doing? Like, why are they hitting Lebanon continually, particularly southern Lebanon, but also like the suburbs of Beirut, right? So there was a report, there was Zionist reports coming out, I think, in the last few days that Hezbollah is rebuilding the supply lines in Syria that were sort of cut off after the coup in Syria in December are being reestablished. To connect back Iran to Lebanon and Hezbollah. So, you know, it's interesting to see like this rhetoric. You know, we can talk about whether it's a psychological operation or whether it's real. I think there's some real elements to it. I don't, Bikram or Diego, I don't know if you guys want to elaborate on some of these points.
I mean, I think, it's interesting. One thing that you saw a report, there's the headline on Al-Mayadeen right now about an Israeli border wall crossing into Lebanon, violating the blue line. If we think Lebanon and Gaza together in some ways, we know like in Gaza, for example, they have 52% under Israeli occupation. And I think there's a way in which you can see in both Lebanon and Gaza, again, what we're talking about in Venezuela, is there's a demonstrative effect that they're going for, is that we possess escalation dominance, right? We possess the power to escalate and we possess the power to occupy, right? I think this is what they're trying to demonstrate. And the reality in Gaza and Lebanon is that the resistance is not only not disarmed, but it continues to be present in such a way that really prevents any attempt at a permanent occupation, right? But there, you can still see that doesn't undermine the point that like there is clearly a gambit at a normalization of an occupation, both in the south of Lebanon and in Gaza. And I think the Americans are really like trying to advance this even further. And I think with Lebanon, like, there are a couple of objectives. One is, I think there is this objective of an anxiety around Hezbollah and the rearmament of Hezbollah. Or even if that's not happening, it's clear they haven't disarmed them. But then on the other hand, it's like, I think it's a process of shaping the character of the Lebanese state as a whole as well. You know, there's an attempt to do what they're trying to do in Latin America. And we see Petro responding in a particular way. And the question is, which way will it go in Lebanon? Right? Which way will the social forces move? Right? Is it going to be, well, the problem with the bombing is Hezbollah, we must isolate Hezbollah? Or is it going to be clarification that the real enemy is Zionism, as we've heard the Lebanese leadership, you know, off and on come to that realization? But, you know, the Saudis have an objective, the Gulf states have an objective of isolating the resistance. Is this a way that they're trying to shape the character of the Lebanese state as well?
I mean, I think the Lebanese state, like, the Lebanese state is, I think the Lebanese state is coming to the realization that they cannot, like, you know, they cannot take essentially a pro-Zionist normalization position, conceivably, like, in any sort of, and be a legitimate, seen as legitimate in any particular way, right? So I think the objectives of the Zionist imperialists in Lebanon are failing, frankly. I watched a podcast with that was an interview with Laith Maarouf from Palestine TV the other day, and he talked about how, like, if the Israelis invade Lebanon again, they'll probably do it from occupied Syrian territory. And if they do so, that'll unleash a whole, like, series, like a whole domino effect in terms of Syria itself. And talking about the potential of then the Syrian resistance, like whatever underground resistance that exists, that's, you know, probably organizing as we speak, to then take advantage of, like, the weak Syrian state, right? And so there's all these kinds of forces at play. And that's not even to talk about, like, the Syrian government and Jolani, right? Like, I'm not totally convinced that, you know, that he's 100% in the pockets of the United States and the Zionist imperialists. I think that that there's particular machinations by Russia that, you know, that are still present there. There's particular machinations by the region's resistance forces, the axis of resistance, that are still playing a role in what's happening in Syria as well, right? And then therefore that filters also into Lebanon, right? So I don't think the objectives, even if the Zionists can claim that they're achieving their objectives, the reality on the ground does not, like, and they can continue to strike as much as they want, but the reality on the ground does not bear out in that way.
I would just jump in just because I think it reminds me of something that was said as to the greater Israel plan, right? To extend Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates, by the prime minister of the wanted ICC for war crimes minister of Israel. I compare that to what you mentioned earlier as to Petro's comment as to the Gran Colombia, right? The Confederation of Latin American countries versus the occupation by force, and the plan of Israel to occupy these spaces with or without anyone's consent. We're just going forward with this, and how that plays into the impunity rule that you mentioned earlier, Bikram, as an extension of the American imperialism's impunity and a reflection of it in the Caribbean right now, right? How Israel has for years acted with impunity in front of the international community. And now we see the United States being the United States, performing the same, or obviously not the same functions, but acting with the same impunity, right? And I just wanted to throw that out there because I am not as versed on the specifics of what's going on currently in that. I mean, in general, I am, but not in specific terms as you guys. But I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah. The one thing that I was thinking as well was, see how self-conscious you got me, Diego? There's this, the Central Bank of Lebanon today just announced, like, they're going to be tightening, I think, rules and regulations around money transfers, right? And this is, like, around financial flows And this was like, I think the day after or a couple of days after the United States explicitly called for containment of the transfer of funds to Hezbollah or the movement of resources. And I think, you know, we can think about the way that relates to the Israeli, we can speculate, right? Like the constant Israeli airstrikes. And then the United States say can be like, in maybe the similar way they were with Qatar, right? Yeah, Israel apologizes to Qatar, but like, it's also this guy you guys may have heard that I enjoy reading, Giovanni Righi. You know, he talks about imperialism as a protection racket, right? Like that, that they'll be like, hey, you want to get smashed or you want to get protected? It's your choice, right? So like, if they're hitting South Lebanon and then you say, well, okay, these airstrikes are happening, and maybe you can stop the money transfers happening, like crack down on those more so, right? So you see the way in which that's happening right now as a continuation of what they're, how they're trying to shape the character of the Lebanese state. But I think the in relation to Petro, the question that's very clear is negotiations. I think this is what Hezbollah has been saying. Negotiations under fire must be rejected, right? There has to be a unity of the state vis-a-vis this, because this is the strategy of imperialism. You apply force, and then you try to turn to a strategy of constitutionalism or treaty making that like authorizes the rule of imperialism under, say, law, right? Like, or what the central bank is doing. So I think Petro recognizes that, right? Like, it's time to meet force with force. And I think that's what Hezbollah has been also speaking of.
Yeah, I mean, I also say that, like, you know, these acts of impunity that both of you have mentioned, to me, reflect the reality that the hegemonic forms of, like, you know, constitutionalism and these things are again failing, and increasingly so. Like the fact that the Zionist regime has to act with impunity, right? And like, let's be clear, has to, right? Like, and because if it doesn't, then it'll continue to lose ground in the region, right? And so but that in and of itself escalates the contradictions in the region and thereby drives support to the resistance, right? And so to me, like, this, you know, it's a lose-lose situation for the Zionist imperialists, right? Even, again, I go back to Jelani. One of the things that he said about for stipulation with normalization with the Zionists is that they withdraw from the pre-coup invasion and occupation of Syrian territory, right? So, like, that is a demand that he perhaps probably wouldn't have made. I don't think he made 6 months ago, right? And so, like, again, what are the forces that are coming into play in the region that draw, like, and even embolden someone like Jelani, who is, you know, frankly, a CIA asset, right, to say something like that.
Yeah, it's worth keeping an eye on for sure.
I'll say one more thing. A lot of people criticize Hezbollah for acting with such restraint, right? People have criticized Iran for acting with such restraint. But the primary task of any resistance movement, or the primary task of a state, like, should be to protect its own people, right? So you can't, like, ask these resistance forces to constantly engage in military actions, because if they're, like, if they derive their legitimacy and support from the general population, from the popular cradle, then it's self-defeating to continually to have to engage with these more powerful military forces, right? So you have to do the dance of what a Vietnamese resistance leader, Lê Duẩn, talks about, talking and fighting, right? How do we negotiate talking on the one hand versus fighting on the other? When do we talk? When do we fight? Right? And so we have to be clear that these negotiations are not meaningless, right? They're designed to produce particular contradictions, or at least expose those contradictions, to thereby give legitimacy to actually more overt forms of resistance. And I think, so whenever, anytime we talk about, like, the criticisms of Hezbollah for acting with such restraint, you know, even beyond, like, the discussion of, like, they've been hit hard, we have to be clear, like, okay, they have a strategy, right? And part of that strategy is to engage in negotiations, even if those negotiations are with bad faith actors, right? So I really think it's important to bring that up as well.
No, I remember you mentioning this in one of our last episodes, that you and Charisse were talking about, and the need of the resistance to feed, you know, the population, because the population is the substance of the resistance, and that reciprocal relationship needs to occur, and that you need to sometimes engage in these negotiations, just so that the people see that you're actually trying to and set up a system in which you know they're going to fail, but to the people, you tried. Navid, just one comment. Your camera is shaking too much and I'm getting sick. It's sort of all over the place. And I know that Bikram can't say anything because he's drinking coffee, but I can say something about it. I think that this could be a good point of departure to another topic, but I mean, it's up to you guys if there's anything else we can jump into. And I'm looking at you, Bikram. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this topic?
There was something I wanted to say, but now that you mentioned me drinking coffee, I have forgotten what it was. So I guess it wasn't that important.
No, it'll come back. Don't worry about it. I know you're jet lag and all. Yeah. But we do have our next topic is going to be on Russia. Just so that everyone is aware, we will be hosting our first event on Russia, and we have a great panel showed up. So for those who are listening to this, it may be too late, but certainly we'll talk about this next week or our next episode when we'll be inviting some of the members who were at the panel. But aside from that, there is news coming out of the Russia sphere. So Navid, do you have anything that you want to share with us about this?
I mean, yeah, really quickly, I'll just say that speaking of failures, right, like Zionist imperialist failures, imperialist in this case, Marco Rubio comes out today and says that basically we're running out of ways to sanction Russia, and basically calling on the European partners, quote unquote partners, really adjuncts of the United States to increase their pressure, their economic pressure on Russia. So you know, again, speaking to reality,
it came out like a guys, come on, help us out. You know, we're the good guys. We're really trying here, but you guys keep like doing stuff. And I mean, we're trying to contain them, and yet they find a way to get out. And it's all your fault. We can't do anything else, right? It's on you now. But at the same time, you need to adopt our philosophy and our vision as to what works and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a really strong statement coming out of Marco Rubio, like the ones he routinely throws out when he talks about the Caribbean, right? This was a much more measured response to his audience out in Europe, and also at the same time, the adversary, which is Russia in this case.
Right. But you know, it's interesting because Rubio, I think way back, like at the beginning of the administration, also there was some strange comment he made about like recognizing that I feel like he said like that the world is shifting to a multipolar world. I believe Rubio had kind of made that concession almost. But I mean, I think Diego, though, like what can Rubio do, right? Like, you know, the language may be different, but they don't have the means of sanctioning Russia. Like we are like, what, over 10 years now into this. You know, I know the sanctions accelerated post 2022, but like we're talking 2014 to 2025 now. And you know, like we haven't mentioned China yet, which always comes up, especially when I'm on the show. But like, you know.
Yes, we are aware.
I want to say I did mention China earlier with their aircraft carrier. But
that's great.
True.
I think like there's not an ability to sanction Russia because of the way China has established control again over the flow of global economic surpluses. Right. So they are able to purchase Russian oil, and they are able to help construct like alternative economic and financial architecture that can like facilitate the bypassing of U.S. sanctions, right, in a way that wasn't possible before. So I'm hearing like a train in the background.
Oh, that's me. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I live near a train track down by the river.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah, listen, our producer Sina just wanted to send over the statements from Marco Rubio that you made reference before in an interview with Megyn Kelly. And again, thank you to our great producer, of course. Feel free to donate at the end of the show. This is what he said. So it's not normal for the world to simply have a unipolar power. That was an anomaly. It was a product of the end of the Cold War, but eventually you are going to reach back to the point, where you had a multipolar world, multi-great powers in different parts of the planet. We face that now with China and to an extent Russia. And then you have rogue states like Iran and North Korea you have to deal with. So end quote.
Yeah. So I think like there's a hard fact that, you know, they have to confront. But I think the other like component of this, I think Rubio making this like plea for more like support from their allies or whatever as it comes to targeting Russia. You know, they've been putting a lot of pressure on India, for example, because India was a key state that was not abiding by U.S. sanctions. But I think there's a second component beyond simply their inability to impose sanctions. I know this has been a running theme through some of our episodes, but it is necessary to take into account how the United States across, I think, the last four administrations from Obama, Trump 1, Biden, Trump 2, is clearly going all in on oil and gas, right? On that there's a link that's being identified, recognized in advance between the maintenance of U.S. power, maybe not U.S. alone, but the U.S. as the major power amongst other powers, that oil and gas will be the mechanism through which they do so. By maintaining oil and gas as the heart of the world economy, which you can understand then, it's not simply ideological, the attack on climate change, like the attack on the idea of climate change, that there's something quite material that is driving this, is the role that control over the flow of oil and gas plays in U.S. hegemonic power. And, you know, the way that Russia had threatened that in its relationship with Europe, right? And so I think like, and the way the Trump administration is even more aggressively seeking to establish U.S. control, you know, there's a direct profitability question that U.S. firms make. But then there's a other deeper question about how this allows them to exercise power over contending states by keeping oil at the center of the world economy, how this props up the dollar. And I don't mean to be a broken record, but there's also a link in the way in which they're seeking to power their AI sector, in opposition.
No, I was actually going to jump in right there on that specific point, because you made that point, I think, on an earlier episode as to how the United States missed the boat when it came to climate change by doubling down on oil and gas. And now this entire new energy sector and its profitability, they're lagging years, if not decades, in technology to China and other nations, right? So now they don't want to miss the boat on the AI thing. And that's when you see that doubling down impact. But it is having a significant issue of data centers being, I mean, actually, nuclear power plants being brought back online, not to reduce costs, but to ensure that some random company has access to infinite energy. This is like this is what superhero movies, they start off like this, right? When the villain actually comes off and just buys off nuclear power plants in order to entertain their energy needs and everything around it, just this destruction mode. But yeah, I do appreciate that link, because it is an important link. We see how back in during the elections, there was a big push by big tech to equate China and AI with like a survival of nations, right? It's a competition to death, right? It's a all or nothing, right, game that we were in. And I do believe that the United States is doubling down in that investment just so that they can survive the next capitalist phase, a modification or iteration.
Yeah, I mean, I there's a couple of things I want to say about this. So first of all, I mean, both of you know, for example, that the U.S., the Trump government recently basically bailed out Argentina, right? Was it $20 billion bailout?
40. So 40. 20 now and 20 later.
Okay, good. So yeah, so... And what did Argentina turn around and do? Like they increased their consumption of Chinese, was it soy products, or I don't remember what it was, but
Well, the Milei it's all over the place now, right? Yeah. He's facing corruption charges, but as you say properly, right? As you're properly indicating, that investment in Latin America is coming back, according to Trump.
Yeah. But you know, so yeah, so the bailout money, like, you know, is actually going toward trade with China is the point I'm getting at. The second thing I'll say is actually directly related to Russia and its relationship with Europe, right? So one of the authors of our Russia issue this month, or last month, I should say, I think his name is Arto Artinian, I may be mispronouncing that, talked about how like during the 1970s and 80s, there was a crisis of accumulation in the West, right? And how, in fact, the collapse of the Soviet Union mitigated and, in fact, you know, really rectified that crisis of accumulation for at least 20 years, so that it opened up new markets for the West in not just Russia, but particularly the other post-Soviet states, right? And so what we're seeing now is like this crisis of accumulation on steroids, essentially, right? That Russia is, you know, the West is closing off Russia itself, right? But also, you know, because of that, you know, access to you know, Russian oil and gas, right? Now the U.S. is trying to replace that access in the European market, but it's not enough to equip the needs of the people in Europe. Right. So this accumulation is escalating the this crisis is escalating the contradictions on geopolitical terms as well. Right. So I think it's really important to think about that as well.
I mean, it's quite shocking the way in which German elites have committed a form of national suicide almost. Right. Like European elites more generally. But you see what's happened to German industry, especially since 2022, like German petrochemical industries. Of course, like a big part of the story is something, Diego, you were talking about, is the Chinese really starting to outcompete the Germans on, say, capital goods manufacturing, right? Which was like a strength, right, for, let's say, German automotive engineering or German engineering in general. But one part of how they're outcompeting, if you're being outcompeted, and what the Chinese really outcompete them on is on costs, right? That the Chinese can now produce the same capital goods, but at a fraction of the cost. But surely it wasn't to Germany's advantage to start paying much more in energy costs than they would have been doing before, right? So, like, there's a way that accumulation crisis in the 70s. It's interesting, you know, that you mentioned that, because it's an accumulation crisis that is both generated by decolonization, right? The fact that you have national development projects that might make it difficult now to continue to recycle value from periphery to core, especially cheap resources. But there's also a sharpening contradiction between core states, right? So Germany, Japan, and the United States entering into more intensive competition. And the United States will often try to resolve it, right? By squeezing their allies. You know, they do that to eventually Japan. You know, Japan's been a stagnant economy now for like so many decades. And, you know, in the 2000s, they start to squeeze the Europeans a little bit, right? And this is one objective of their war on Russia, is to try to appropriate more profits to their firms that they're being outcompeted by in relation to Europe, right? So I think the contradictions exist in multiple ways of world capitalism and imperialism. But yeah, I think that is continues to be a key through line in what might be a 50 years crisis. Some people call it from the 70s till today. But yeah, I think the accumulation crisis is a key part of the story.
I think this reminds me of Vice President J.D. Vance's statements regarding China, how the entire neoliberal project was meant to keep China producing the world's low-end products. And without knowing how they turned that around and became high-end producers, which, as Vikram correctly points out, now they're out producing the major nations in around the globe. And the detriment that it had along the chain of what periphery, semi-periphery, and colonized nations in the economic sector, right? How that realization by the United States has reshifted its entire calculus as to geopolitics around the world at an accelerated rate, and how the Chinese, taking advantage of the American, taking for granted Latin America, how they just basically shifted to West Asia and addressing Europe, the Chinese came in with investment deals that were highly preferable in terms of competition when it comes to what the Americans were offering, right? There is a diplomatic soft power issue that has been abandoned by the United States, and we see it now, right? Now it's the Monroe Doctrine. I think there were statements yesterday by Rubio or 2 days ago saying that the United States should be allowed to bomb anything anywhere in the Western Hemisphere because yes, that's the actual policy position, because yes. I should trademark that. So basically, I'm sorry, I just went off. Let's go back to China and Bitcoin.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Came back. Look who.
you're welcome. I set you up.
Well, so no, I was just going to say for folks listening in, like the point you made, Diego, around J.D. Vance saying China was meant to remain. That is the truth. And it's interesting. I didn't know J.D. Vance said that, but that's like actually the reality of the situation. Even granting China access to the World Trade Organization. There's an article that for folks who don't mind reading academic pieces by, I don't remember the first names, but Machado and Natalini. It's in the Review of African Political Economy. It's called Samir Amin in Beijing. So, you know, Arighi obviously has his book, Adam Smith in Beijing. These guys have this book, Samir Amin in Beijing, which actually traces how the Communist Party was able to counteract the capitalist law of value and to constantly engage in technological upgrading and moving their labor into higher value sectors over a period of decades. And, you know, we can't get into that kind of right now. But what's really interesting also is, you know, you have a situation where the Europeans are basically in the pages of the Financial Times and elsewhere. They're saying, how are we going to convince China? We have to engage China because they're outstripping us now. They're outcompeting us, not just in the manufacture of cell phones, right? They're outcompeting us in the manufacture of the very machines that produce the cell phones, right? In capital goods production. So how can we need to cooperate with China in order to gain access to Chinese technology. Can you believe, right? So they're talking about technology transfer from China to Europe. Right. And they're trying to they're speaking almost like developing countries now in relation to China. They're saying, how do we put conditions on Chinese investment? So we have to insist on technology sharing. And that's a dramatic transformation from the 1980s and 90s when, you know, it was China that was actually putting conditions on Japanese firms or other firms in regards to technology transfer. Right. So. I think in relation to what you were saying, I think that's a really, I noticed that in the article about the collapse of German industry, which I really encourage everybody to look into right now, because it is shocking how rapidly, and what's going to replace that in Germany, I don't know, because I don't think there's a German Wall Street waiting to step up to replace industrial output.
So Bikram, if I can jump in. Diego or Bikram, like, why do you all think that the German government is basically spiting itself in order to double down on this war against Russia, and has this increasing accumulation crisis? Is, I agree, like, acting essentially is a developing country at this point compared to China. So why double down? I mean, I have an opinion on this, but like, I'm interested to hear you all, like, why double down on this war when it in fact is escalating, like it is elevating and heightening the contradictions within German society itself, right?
I think that I'll address that in this answer. I remember Bikram mentioning right now how Europeans were requesting or dealing with the technology transfer. And what I wanted to bring up was how the United States is against that. No technology transfer from the Chinese, and now we're placing all technology from China as spy networks, right? Everything is spy related. Everything has to do with the fact that TikTok must be first.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
No, even like buses. I think it was in the UK or some other European country. They're like, oh, are these buses spying on us, right?
TikTok is a spy tool, even though what they do is what every other technology company in the United States does, right? So it's that fear. And I think it goes with your question, Navid. It's the fear of commerce. It's the fear of who is the metropole, who's semi-periphery, and who's... And right now you have nations that were sort of more getting to the point of being the core, and now they're being pushed back into the periphery. And yet the United States is doubling down on its own survival. And to do that, we have to force these conditions on the semi-peripheral states, such as Japan, who has lasted all this time and is still trying to get out of this cycle. Germany is falling into that cycle too. Something that has happened throughout Europe. It's not just unique to Germany. You see states like other states, Greece, Spain, and many more who have. But I wanted to highlight the contradiction in that even though the states and the leaders are acting away, we have a population that has been very vocal against these type of actions, against the let's throw away our relationship with the Russian oil. And of course, I want to pay 400% more in gas prices because of this. And there has been local resistance all across these countries trying to push back on the policies implemented by their leader. So I want to highlight that because we need to be aware of the state and its people, right? It's like the United States, it's not Trump. It's everything. Now, we can debate how different it is, but what I want to highlight also that there has been pushback in all these countries. Not necessarily in electoral, it doesn't translate to electoral wins, but it's certainly there is a resistance all over these countries.
Yeah, and like Naveed, I think like it's important to remember that like you know we can broadly think about like an Atlantic project, like an Atlanticist project, and a Eurasian future, right? Which is like you know you can think of, and there's like a really interesting that you know, in mindful of Diego's concerns, I'm not going to get into it in depth, but you know, there's an interesting theoretical point around how the Americas changed the world, right? I think Michel Rolf Triot makes this point, the Haitian anthropologist, theorist, that, and you think about the way in which like the United States as a settler colonial power really reshapes even Europe's relations with the rest of the world, you know, after the conquest of the Americas. That aside, I think like, you know, the place of Germany in Europe has obviously been a vexing question since the 19th century, right? Like, and the question of German power and what to do with it and maintaining a balance of power on the continent. But, you know, in the early 2000s, you have, after the Iraq War, you have the French and Germans actually speaking and operating sometimes as a bloc with the Russians and Chinese, really explicitly identifying the United States as this kind of, if not rogue, but that the U.S. is the threat to world order, right? Like with the invasion of Iraq, you know, and, you know, like Putin before then is actually trying to work with the Americans, Vancouver to Vladivostok, you know, universal security architecture, whatever it is. And after Iraq, they're kind of like, wow, this is a very irrational power, the United States. You can't trust it. The French and the Germans at the time, you can remember, especially the Germans, they have different relations with the Russians, but also with the oil, the West Asian states. Like, you know, it's not clear. And at that time, Robert Kaplan writes an essay, you know, like the coming war with China, where basically he makes this point that the United States cannot lose the Europeans to Eurasia because they will have to fight China. Like Kaplan is saying, there is a war that will come with China in the coming decades. And it's very important the Europeans are on the side of the Americans. And one way he said to do this was to instigate war in the Balkans. So, you know, like, and we know very shortly thereafter in 2007 in Georgia, and then obviously the rolling crisis or instability in Ukraine, the color revolutions and so forth. But Kaplan is very clear that if you instigate war on the borders of these European countries, that will drive them back into the NATO fold, right? And like, it will generate the conditions for an ideological, I guess, framework that would make it very hard for the Europeans. So I think that's one way to make sense of how the wars, maybe the Balkans is not the right word to use, but like, you know, the wars on the
Caucasus.
The Caucasus, like the wars on Russia's borders, mm-hmm. Right? Brought Europe back into the American fold. Now, why would the Germans do that when Merkel, even Angela Merkel, had a slightly more measured, sober policy, right? Like, so why do they walk into that? I don't really know, Naveed. Like, it is going to be a historical question as to how German elites just walked into this, right? Now, beyond economic rationality, the question of racism is something to think about, like the way in which, I think the way in which they understand Russia to be, and this is a question going back to the 19th century, Russia to be a quasi-European country. Is it European? Is it Asian? You know, they had the Putin and the Mongol hordes kind of cover. So, yeah, I don't know, like maybe if you would speak on that, but like the question of racial identity, racial supremacy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think another article in the Russia issue, Pavel Wargon, I may be mispronouncing it once again, the article titled "Whither Russia," in which he cites Brzezinski, and sort of Brzezinski who talks about the prevention of this Eurasian bloc as a way to oppose NATO domination of the world, right? So I think it's very much racial. I think amidst this crisis of accumulation, there are political factors at play that, you know, I mean, we have to be clear, right? Like, for the first time since basically the 15th century, a world power is emerging that is going to be atop the world order that is non-European, non-North American, a non-white power, right? And so there are very clear stakes at hand, right? And you know, this brings China back into the discussion as well, and the relationship between China and Russia. So to me, the political machinations, and we can talk about this with respect to domestic politics in the U.S. as well. The political machinations, in certain respects, are dictating the economic realities, right? The political and racial machinations, and the realities that come from those, right? And so, you know, to me, I mean, there is a very real fear of what a China-led order, world order, looks like, and that fear generates increasing irrationality with respect to racial contradictions, right? And I think that's particularly what's happening. Yeah. Mm.
Great. I think that's a great spot to end this segment. We have two more to go, which is Zionism and the United States wagging the dog, the tail wagging the dog, right? What say you, Bikram? This is something you've been following online?
No, absolutely not. What are you saying? I don't.
Absolutely not. I live online. No, but I think it's an important. Why don't you give us some background?
On this. I mean, I think it's. We have seen obviously, politically, we're seeing this crisis, right? Like across the political spectrum in the United States. And I think this kind of ties together almost everything we've talked about in this episode. But, you know, this brings our very mysterious figure Epstein back into the mix. You know, I think maybe historically, like, is Epstein not the conjuncture, that's not the right word, but is that the place where these questions come into a personification or like an embodiment? Like, which way? Zionism, imperialism, who's wagging who, right? Like, so, but this question, I think, and it's an interesting question, like, why the deflection from Epstein? How does this relate to the relationship between Zionism and American power? But you're seeing, like, the right, the MAGA right, for example, really, really not churning on Trump, but asking questions. And it's funny, right? Because, like Trump is such a... it's so shameless. Like, you know, he's like, oh, I was opposed to all the wars, and we're talking the Caribbean. He's reproducing the very logic of forever endless war, you know? And so his base is questioning this. But on the question of Zionism in particular, right, you're seeing this questioning happening by Tucker Carlson, by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And it's posing a question for those who are urgently, for very rightful reasons, right? Like, I think the past 2 years have brought so much to a standstill for so many of us that the question of Palestinian liberation is urgent. So what do you do tactically, whatever it is, to sharpen those contradictions that are emerging, for example, in the MAGA movement? Is it to say then that Zionism is a force that is counter to U.S. national security, that is counter to the long-run interests of the U.S. state, that it is controlled? You'll see things like the majority of financial power is controlled by Zionists in the United States and so forth, right? So I think like that's a question that is, I think, increasingly now spilling into questions of where does the movement go next, right? Where does the organizing against genocidal forces go next? And I think what I would just say, and Diego, cut me off at any time, I won't take offense to it, but like what I would say is, like, conceptually and theoretically, there may need to be a discussion of the relationship between colonialism and imperialism, like as one beginning point. These are not the same thing. So there is a Zionist colonialism. There is a Zionist colonialism that does lobby the U.S. state, right? That is predominantly targeted upon the conquest and colonization of historical Palestine. And like you were saying, Diego, a greater Israel project in the region itself that draws forth necessarily regional questions. But you can't understand that absent this question of imperialism. So colonialism might be about the territorial conquest, but like we've been talking about, imperialism is about maintaining control over the region and the flow of resources into and out of the region. So the United States does need Zionism as a proxy power, right? And it's a mistake to seek, I think this is, I would defer to Ghassan Kanafani here, it may be a mistake to seek recognition and an alliance with U.S. imperialism, right? To say, can Marjorie Taylor Greene, if she was at the helm of U.S. imperialism, would that change the fact that the U.S. is losing to China and that the U.S. needs to maintain, existentially, it needs to maintain control over West Asian oil. It needs to prevent a Saudi-Iranian detente, and the projection of power through Zionism is essential to this, right? So, like, I think that this question is definitely on the table, but I don't think that has to necessarily undermine the question of centering Zionist power specifically as like a core dynamic or at the center, at the heart of imperialist power. I remember hearing somebody say one time, the Zionist lobby is like walking through an open door. So it's not like they're not, it's not like they're not functioning as a fraction of the US elite or something, but it's still very much aligned with the objectives of US power. And last thing I'll say before turning it over to you guys is like, the, you know, the United States is having an accumulation crisis, but there is also record profitability that's being recorded. Not record profitability, but let's say a restoration of profitability in some ways that we see, right? And now how does this happen? Through military power, the projection of military power, right? Like, the what role does that play? So yeah, I think like those are some questions that I think this political moment is putting forward tactically, strategically, etc. And yeah, would be curious to hear what you all think.
I think that and one of the comments you made regarding the relationship between settler colonialism and imperialism, and how the imperialist project and the area for the United States, there was a from Kamala Harris when she was vice president, she said, our support for Israel is also tied to our capitalist system. There is a relationship between our support with the fact that we get goods that are on prices that we can afford and we can sell products all over the world. And it's tied. I mean, I don't know. This is, I think, the first episode that we can go trace our conversations to what the US government and other leaders are actually saying, because they're saying it out loud. It's just, unfortunately, there's just too much going on for people to pick up and make those connections. And I think that's why it's really important what you said, Bikram, regarding that project, the Zionist settled colonial project, plus the interaction of the United States. I would say, though, that there is a specific reason why that connection has been made with Israel, but I don't think that the United States will go down with Israel. What I mean to say is that you can see the United States easily shifting horses in the middle of the race and dumping one for another. Now, I don't see that happening soon, but it is something possible. We saw how in previous eras, the United States aligned itself all over Latin America with military juntas and dictators all around the world. So I don't foresee that as also a possibility in order to continue the imperialist project, which does not necessarily mean that that's what's going on, right? There is also an affinity when we come to race, according and how white nationalists, Christian nationalists actually, are intimately tied to the Zionist project. And it's primarily due to bias and racism and xenophobia. And I mean, things that those do play a role in these particular moments. So I just, that would, I guess, be my contribution at this moment.
I'll say a couple of things, and I think they're related, actually. So the first thing I'll say, it's good, Bikram, that you started with Epstein, because what we're, to me, like, the whole focus on Epstein and Petro, like, what he says about Epstein and, like, you know, Trump and the government engaging in military operations as a way to cloud the whole Epstein thing, is for one, it's a clear parallel to what with Netanyahu and his corruption trial. Every time, like, he has a court date, he strikes, you know, like he re-engages in military operations, whether in Gaza or Lebanon or elsewhere, right? This to me reflects the trend, the increasing trend toward like the personal politics that reflect fascism, right? Like, this is, you know, the fact that these people are aiming to preserve themselves amid like imperial decline, right, is a reflection of like, you know, the contradictions that creates between, for example, the MAGA people and the neocons here in the U.S., right, or between the, I don't know, what do you want to call them, the liberal Zionists and like the you know, whatever, right? They're all genocidal, but anyway, like, but you know what I mean, like in Israel, right? To me, this all reflects the reality that there is an irreconcilable contradiction in imperialism. And this issue is going to become more and more sort of explicit and over time, right? So to me, and to the other point, like to the second point, which is related, is that the answer to that, and I, Bikram, you mentioned this, right? And I think you cited Ghassan Kanafani, that the answer is not to align ourselves with the MAGA folks, right? Because those folks are the ones who very much support ICE being out in the streets in Chicago or LA or, you know, whatever city, right? So the answer is not that. The answer is, in fact, a reinforcement of internationalism, right? So that Palestinian liberation be linked to Venezuela, that Venezuela be linked to, you know, Los Angeles and so on and so forth, right? That is how we as anti-imperialists address the crisis that is being generated through fascism to then, you know, basically set fire to the world, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's an internationalist question and a class question that should be foregrounded, right? I think, like, you know, what corresponds with the U.S. projection of power through Zionism from the 1970s onwards is the rise of a certain type of financial class power in the United States, right? So, and the hollowing out of the working class in the United States. But like there's this question of, is the question, the control that Zionists hold over U.S., which is true, that is a question to ask. But what that really signifies is, what is the power that a capitalist class holds over your society, whether that capitalist class is, I mean, and why is that capitalist class universally Zionist, right? Because Zionism provisions U.S. capital, you know, with the military projection, with the control over West Asia. So then the question that is attached to this, that you, can the mega forces, the populist forces, be pushed in this direction or not? But the question is, like you're saying, tied to Venezuelan liberation. But why not also pose the question, should the United States maintain domination over West Asia? So it's not simply about, should the United States maintain a relationship with Israel? Should it maintain, I think, Diego, getting to your point, should the United States maintain this sort of domination over the flow of oil into and out of West Asia? Do they need to be conducting themselves in this way? And should class power in the United States be structured in this way? Because if the concern is the power that Zionism have, what that really is a concern with is that there's such dramatic economic inequality that allows particular actors to shape the political system in a certain way. Like, that is where the discussion needs to move towards. Because if it just fixates on this question of, you know, is the United States being controlled by an alien power, it's going to miss the way in which that's only possible within a certain class structure. And the questions that I think there's a space here to ask, because I don't know, like, is it the case? I don't think Americans want to go to war with Venezuela. Like, I think if people really put the question, you know, like, is this something that you want to do? Is it really important to you to maintain control over West Asia? Do you want to have a war in the South China Sea? Right. Like, so I think, yeah, that's, I think in addition to internationalism, the class question is another one that should be foregrounded.
Yeah, absolutely. Really quick, I'll just say, like, you know, the question of Venezuela is also interesting with the MAGAs, because who is it? Like Alex Jones, the guy with InfoWars. He talked about being anti-war with respect to West Asia, but in fact, actually supporting war in Venezuela, right? So, like, so this is why, like, these people, you know, cannot be trusted, right? Like, and so, yeah. I mean, I just, you know, it's really, yeah, I'll just stop there. Yeah.
I think that it's not just these people. I think that earlier we talked about how Latin America's left completely ignores Haiti. I also think there's a belief within the United States that anything that happens in Latin America is our backyard, and we have a right to interfere in many of these locations, and that's been proven hundreds of times with many things. I mean, the number of times I have to push back regarding Puerto Rico and what it is, it's amazing. It's because that's how it's been projected within the United States.
Diego, can I intervene on one quick thing too as well?
Yeah, go ahead.
To what you're saying, Bikram, I think it's also important, and I know both of you know this, right? That the Zionist project is built on anti-communism, right? And so, like, that is a clear class dynamic that reflects that why, for example, as you pointed out, Bikram, are all the billionaires Zionists, right? And at the same time, like, in fact, many Jews are anti-Zionist, right? So, like, I think we should really elevate that, because that also brings into questions of, like, the anti-socialist project with respect to Venezuela, and, you know, and all these things are related.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I think that we have come to the last segment, which is Bikram. Why are you jet lagged? What's going on? Where were you?
You think I'm drinking coffee at 6 in the evening?
Of course you are. Of course you. This is a family friendly show. This is what I tell my kids to listen.
Does that cup have U.S. flags on it, Bikram?
No. Is that U.S. flags? Is that U.S. flags? Oh, I shouldn't edit that out, Stina.
Where did you come from? Where are you?
It says made from plants in the USA.
Oh, made from plants. Okay.
That makes it better. Plants make everything better. Even though I have zero plants in here. I'm like the anti-ecology political ecologist. I was at a conference in Tunis that was under the title Development War and Agriculture, Rethinking the Agrarian Question. It was put on by the Tunisian Observatory for Food Sovereignty. And it was, it was basically a discussion. I mean, the title is pretty self-evident. It was a really rich set of discussions around this thing that, you know, the agrarian question is a pretty central question of Marxism, also of anti-imperialism, right? What role does agriculture play in the capitalist system, but also the transformation of agriculture and agrarian social relations? There was a rich set of discussions because this brings you to questions of land and armed struggle, right? Like, I think these are really core questions. Like, what is sovereignty? How do you construct a sovereign development project in the world as it is today? What role does sovereignty over land play in constructing broader sovereign industrialization and whatnot? And I can share what I presented on in 30 seconds.
Bikram, we will indulge you.
Okay. All right. So watch,
take your time.
Before, and we'll indulge you, but I also want to hear Diego talk about Bad Bunny, but go ahead, Bikram.
Yeah. Always. He won 5 Latin awards last night.
I presented a paper for, just as an example, that was trying to put Zimbabwe's land reform in the 2000s, the fast track land reform program, into conversation with the Second Intifada in Palestine. And I think the idea was thinking about this framework of the agrarian question of national liberation, bringing questions of national liberation into conversation with the agrarian question. And the agrarian question for the colonized and for the South is a question, in some ways, of, to put it very simply, reclaiming land from the settler or from the colonizer, establishing a form of popular sovereignty that distributes land, whether on a collective or household basis, to the peasantry, which can then ground a universal sovereign development project, right? Now, it's the case that in both Palestine through Oslo and in Zimbabwe through the Lancaster House Agreement at the quote-unquote end of history when the Soviet Union falls, in both of these places, there was an end of the land question, right? It was imagined that you don't now, the third world project of the Fanonian project, through force, you reclaim land, and through force, you establish the basis of a different type of sovereignty. So in both Lancaster House and Oslo, it's you don't do that by force, you do that through the market, right? And Palestinians, you'll eventually get your state in the West Bank, economic development and so forth, put down your guns. And to Zimbabwe, it was the same thing, right? Do not take land from white settler farmers by force, the market will do it. But we know by the 1990s in both Zimbabwe and Palestine, no land is being redistributed. So I try to think about how it's a return to armed struggle. It's a return to the question of force in the 2000s. It's and I try to frame this as two major shots that are fired against the U.S. unipolar moment, the U.S. imperialist moment, and how this really grounds the renewal of anti-imperialism in the 21st century, right? The way in which the Second Intifada is a key part of what eventually leads to the Al-Aqsa flood. And in Zimbabwe, you actually have finally the redistribution of the majority of white settler land to indigenous Africans in Zimbabwe as well. So those are the type of discussions that we were having, broadly focused on the West Asian region. It's interesting to think about at this moment, right? Because you have a moment with the Gaza peace plan and elsewhere where it seems as though the application of overwhelming military force is trying to return people in the region to a disarmed and disorganized condition through which you can impose a series of agreements or a constitutional power, right, that forces people to abide by rules, which undercut their sovereignty. But as we saw in Zimbabwe and Palestine at the turn of the century, history is seemingly moving in the direction of like where anti-imperialist force continues to respond. And we're seeing that in Gaza today, right? So yeah, that was the, and there was a lot of comrades from our collective who were at the conference, Max Ahil, Karina Mullen, Helia Dutagi, Mama Dutal. Now I feel bad because if I forget anybody, but yeah, I think ISK, or I don't know however you said it, ISK was well represented, Diego.
Shout out to Sam Moyo.
And Paris Hero, Sam Moyo's co-author, was there. And yeah, Sam Moyo, a major influence, I think, on our collective, who tragically passed away 10 years ago in a car accident, actually, in India, and is a founding member of the Agrarian South Journal, which everybody should check out all the time. Mm-hmm. Really, we can talk about that another time, the significance of the Agrarian South as a site of knowledge production. But yeah, shout out Sam Oyo. The Patnaiks were there. I think some of our intellectual influences were definitely very present. So yeah, it was a good conference.
Yeah, listeners, read Sam Oyo, Paris Yaros. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like required reading.
Diego, before. Yeah, go ahead. I want you to talk about Bad Bunny, like what's your beef with Bad Bunny? I don't know if
I'll get to it, but I just wanted to add, because what you're saying, Bikram, it resonates so much in the Caribbean right now due to climate change and how the entire calculus is shifting, what land is used for, how it's used for. Are we using agricultural land for solar energy? Or are we, I mean, Puerto Rico, pre-Hurricane Maria, which is in 2017, statistics were like 99% of all food supplies were imported, and how much in what dependency issues are going in. So it's a fascinating discussion, which I would love to look at through the lens of the Caribbean and climate change. I remember some comments from Belize and the president. I think that Belize has like one of the biggest reserves in the world that along with the Amazon, it's one of the biggest in the Western Hemisphere. That is used as one of the hearts of the lungs, I'm sorry, of the world. So it's that calculus. Should we charge the Western Hemisphere for that resource? How do we play into that role? So it's just so many things that can come out.
Right.
The important thing is that we're going to talk about Bad Bunny.
Right? Yeah, well, let me say one thing, one serious thing.
Okay.
Because you mentioned like 98% of the food is imported in Puerto Rico before
98, 99. Yeah.
I mean, I was in the Virgin Islands in St. Croix a couple of years ago, and it was something similar, like 95%. And it's like, you know, these countries, they grow their own food and then they have to export them and then re-import them, right? Like that's the contradiction that we're talking about.
Yeah, actually, and, you know, just to build on that, that's like the agrarian question of our time in many ways, is like this way in which food is integrated into a global kind of network of accumulation that's very irrational when it comes to actually sovereign national development, right? And I think like, so those are really important questions that the Patnaiks really talk about a lot, talked about at the conference again.
Yeah, and one thing when it comes back, it's coming back in merchant marine boats, and those are 75% more expensive than normal prices. So your same banana, the one you're producing in Puerto Rico, goes back and forth, and it's shipped to us at a higher rate. Mm. So yeah, it's increasing prices. So that's a great thing to talk about. Let's switch gears to what really everyone was waiting for, which is my review of Bad Bunny. So I just wanted to add something. One second.
Is there a new album?
No, well, he hasn't come with a new album, but just in general, just Bad Bunny's existence. Just wanted to let you know that I have bought his vinyl. Everything is in here. This is his latest record, the one that he made famous by the Puerto Rican tour that he had. 30 shows in like two months.
You couldn't get tickets to it.
No, I didn't get tickets. So how dare he? So I think that he got 5 Grammys last night, Latin Grammy. So good for him. And remember, folks, to learn Spanish if you want to understand anything that's going on with the Super Bowl coming up, which was funny because obviously when that came out, everyone was like, oh, my God, how do we have a foreigner talking something else? In our entertainment, and they tried to do like a side project or an alternate Super Bowl show for the people that were pissed at Bad Bunny, and they couldn't get anyone to go up against him. So I guess that's where we end. So be like Bad Bunny, speak another language and piss me off. There you go. Does anyone have any projects coming up? Anything coming up besides Thanksgiving and taking some time off? Correct to start grading.
I have a move coming up, but maybe I'll hold off on speaking about that in the future.
Yeah. But, yeah. You have a right to remain silent. I'm an attorney, so you're good.
I'm not very good at upholding that right, but I will.
Oh, we know. That's why I'm here. Don't worry about it. Navid, do you have anything you want to share? You're good.
I mean, I'll just quickly say, really quickly say, we had a conference on Black internationalism at our campus this week. A shout out to Sharice Burdenstelly, one of the members of our collective, who was the main organizer for that conference. And it was excellent. We had Akinyele Umoja, who has a book out on Robert and Mabel Williams, an edited book, memoir, I think. We had Natanya Duncan and other folks on campus, Keto Swan. So it was excellent. And I'll just say quickly, it's really, really big shout out to Akinyele Umoja, who talked about not just like, he talked about Black internationalism, not just in a global sense, but also talk about supporting struggles for, obviously Native American liberation struggle, talked about Puerto Rico, talked about Hawaii. You know, I just want to shout out Dr. Umoja. Yeah.
Excellent. So just to sign off before we do, just want to say thank you to everyone who's listening. Make sure you subscribe to both. You can subscribe at our to our podcast and at your favorite platform, just like Apple Podcasts. If you leave a review, a positive one of 5 stars would be great, because that helps our ratings and it makes sure that other people find our podcast. I also want to encourage you to visit our website at antiimperialist.com. That's anti-imperialist.com. And visit our blog. It's called The Pen Is My Machete. And you will find our latest issue. Also at our website, you can subscribe to our newsletter. We try to publish something every week that's of interest of what we do, our publications, and some highlights, upcoming events, and anything that we think that you might enjoy. And finally, you can visit all of our socials at Pen and Machete. That's at PENMY Machete, MACHETE. Again, this is the Anti-Imperialist Scholars Collective podcast, or as I call it, the ICE podcast. Bikram calls it something else, but
ACE podcast,
but he's a lot smarter than me. That's what he gets paid the big bucks. So signing out. See you guys next time. If not, I hope you miss us. Take care, guys. Nice seeing you. We'll be right back.